Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Alex Lawson, Executive Director of the group Social Security Works, who talks about overwhelming opposition to the Republican Party's proposed budget that calls for $880 billion in cuts to Medicaid to pay for trillions of dollars in tax breaks for the rich. Maria J. Stephan of the Horizons Project, who assesses the growing nationwide protest movement opposing Donald Trump and Elon Musk's coup and the power of collective defiance in nonviolent direct action. And Michael Girard, director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School, who discusses New York City's congestion pricing program that Donald Trump is now attempting to shut down. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Soon after Ken Martin was elected the Democratic National Committee chair, he published a memo laying out his vision for the party's new direction. Martin, credited with electing a progressive majority in his home state of Minnesota, speaks about the urgent need to make Democrats the true party of labor and working people. In the Biden years, a pro-union president was not enough to reverse the decline of labor. Since 2020, union density in the workforce continued to decline. Now less than 10% of private sector workers belong to a union. As a result, the union movement is too weak to break the newly empowered Trump-Musk oligarchy on its own. In these times, Hamilton Nolan observes that America has an economic system that produces great inequality and a political system that allows money to directly buy political power. He notes that the people who run the Democratic Party got there by being good at catering to the rich. Now the party must fight the rich or be crushed. Therefore, the party itself needs to radically remake its leadership. If it doesn't, Nolan asserts, it will not be able to become an effective opposition party, and all of us will suffer for it. Early on in the second Trump regime, a group of Venezuelan detainees were sent to the U.S. Immigration Detention Facility in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In an effort to promote Trump's draconian immigration policies in the media, these shackled migrants were paraded before TV cameras as they were sent to Guantanamo on nearly empty military transport planes. Although Trump said he intended to expand the Guantanamo detention facility to hold 30,000 migrants, the administration transported almost all 178 Venezuelan migrants out of Guantanamo on February 20th. After the operation had raised questions about whether the government had legitimate legal authority to take people from ICE facilities in the U.S. to Guantanamo. The immigration detention facility in Cuba is separate from the military prison used to hold terrorism suspects. According to The Guardian, the government contractor Akima, which will operate the Guantanamo Detention Center, has been the subject of critical audits and a civil rights complaint over conditions and inappropriate use of force at three other U.S. migrant prisons it runs. Jesse Franzblau of the National Immigrant Justice Center asserted, sending people to Guantanamo without any due process or access to counsel flies in the face of U.S. and international law. Argentina's president, Javier Milei, a budget-slashing, chainsaw-wielding libertarian, has been implicated in a scandal over his promotion of a new cryptocurrency, the Libra, which quickly inflated and then crashed. Critics accused Milei of complicity in a pump-and-dump scheme, where thousands of crypto investors lost their money. The scheme began on a Friday night in mid-February when Milei endorsed the nearly worthless crypto token on his official X social media account, maintaining it would be dedicated to boosting the growth of the Argentinian economy by funding small businesses and entrepreneurs. Its value rapidly rose to over $5 before quickly crashing to under $1. Argentina's left-leaning opposition have called for an impeachment inquiry, and federal prosecutors will reportedly now examine whether the president engaged in fraud or criminal association with the scam. Lawyers filed charges saying Milei was a full participant in the rug pull scheme. Milei maintains that he wasn't involved in any stage of the cryptocurrency's development. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Having won the presidency, the House and the U.S. Senate on November 5th, Republicans scored what's referred to as a trifecta, where the GOP potentially now has the power to enact Donald Trump's legislative agenda. As was the case in his first term, Trump wants to reduce federal taxes on the wealthiest Americans and corporations, many of whom supported his campaign with millions of dollars in contributions. On February 25th, the House narrowly voted to take the first step toward moving a budget plan forward that would extend the president's 2017 tax cuts, increasing the federal deficit by up to $4.5 trillion that the GOP wants to offset by making $2 trillion in spending cuts. Their budget proposal includes $100 billion in new spending on immigration enforcement and the military, and $880 billion in cuts to federal programs. Those cuts will most likely come from Medicaid, that provides health care coverage to more than 72 million Americans and pays for exorbitant expenses for 60% of all nursing home residents. But with a razor-thin majority in the House, Republican Speaker Mike Johnson can't afford to lose any support, either from moderate members of his party or conservative budget hawks. Your reporter spoke with Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works, who talks about growing opposition to the GOP budget plan that, if enacted, would eliminate millions of Americans' access to affordable health care.
You know, if we weren't living in and seeing the other things that the Trump administration and the unelected monarch Elon Musk are doing, they wouldn't be believable that this is what they're proposing, but it's what they're proposing. It's $880 billion in cuts to Medicaid. It's basically an elimination of food assistance, SNAP, providing meals for seniors, for example, people with disabilities. Medicaid is primarily serves seniors, children, people with disability. And besides that, the majority of people work and are on Medicaid. It provides health care. That's all it provides. You can't live on Medicaid alone. It just provides health care. So if you take it away from people, they get sick and they die. That's what's being proposed.
Alex, on Medicaid, there's a lot of people across the country, when they hear the term Medicaid, they think it's a federal program just for the poor, just for people on the other side of town, if they happen to be middle-class folks. But in reality, as I understand it, 60% of all the people in nursing homes, as they get older and they need assisted living, 60% of them are getting and receiving Medicaid payments to maintain themselves in these facilities. Tell us a little bit about that, because that affects a lot of people, and they're not all on the other side of the tracks if you think you're one of the middle-class lucky folks who don't have to engage in Medicaid.
Medicaid is the largest provider of long-term care in this country. For the vast majority of Americans, it's the only provider of long-term care in this country. Long-term care, which costs, on average, $100,000 a year, right? $100,000 a year. But you remove Medicaid and you're turning them into absolute death traps. They will close. And people who need this care, the only thing that will be able to be there for them is if their family can step up. And in so many of these cases, a family's not equipped for somebody who's deep in dementia, Alzheimer's, a host of other conditions that need skilled nursing facilities. That's what the proposal would destroy, the only long-term care system that we have in this country. And let me also be clear, Medicaid's not actually a long-term care system. We don't have a long-term care system. It's just a system that's there as a last resort. I want to say that there's been a bit of a change, a vibe shift, a change in consciousness and understanding about Medicaid. For a long time, it used to be true that people saw Medicaid as the weak one, you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and they'd be like, oh, well, I think people will be okay with cutting Medicaid because they think it only helps other people. I'll tell you, I've been all around this country. We have an enormous amount of public opinion polling to back this up as well, but I've seen it with my eyes. Because so many people have now gone through the terrible, absolutely brutal, cruel process of long-term care for their parents, because the generation is taking care of their aging parents is now making decisions, the fierceness of the refusal to cut Medicaid is as high as, you know, the refusal to cut Medicare. Because more and more people understand that without Medicaid, their family members, their loved ones will die in horrible ways, kicked out of a skilled nursing facility and just brought into their house where they won't have at all the facilities or the skills to care for them. So when I travel around the country, I never hesitate to center Medicaid and tell people the Republicans are attacking Medicaid. And 4 out of 5 Americans say clearly, hands off our Medicaid, because people understand that along with Social Security, Medicare, yes, Medicaid, and a host of these other programs, including food assistance for some seniors, Meals on Wheels is the only interaction that a person will get. And the cruelty of taking this away is only multiplied. It's massively multiplied when you realize why they're doing it. They're going to kill people. They're going to harm people, seniors, people with disabilities, and yes, millions of children who will become sicker, all so that they can give tax handouts to billionaires like Elon Musk. That's the whole goal. And the thing is, not only the frontliners, but a lot of others. I mean, Mike Johnson, the speaker himself, you know what percentage of people in his district get their health care from Medicaid? 23%, a quarter of his constituents. He's going to steal their health care. If we can just let people know, the people will demand that they keep their hands off of Medicaid and will have put sand in the gears. Well, won't have stopped it because they will come back with another cruel and stupid proposal. It'll be a struggle and a battle for a long time. But the strategy that we need to keep in mind, sand in the gears, hasten buyer's remorse. We need to slow everything down and open the people's eyes to what is actually happening here, which is a full-scale looting of America by billionaires.
That was Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works. Learn more about the campaign to stop Donald Trump and the Republicans' plan to make major cuts to Medicaid and other social safety net programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the immediate aftermath of Donald Trump's November election victory, large numbers of those opposed to a second Trump regime were depressed, angry, and disengaged. But after Trump and billionaire Elon Musk launched their unconstitutional attempt to eliminate entire federal agencies and recklessly fire tens of thousands of government employees without due process, many Americans were infuriated and eager to take action. 5051, a decentralized rapid response hub, created a spark tapping into Trump opponents' yearning for collective action that resulted in 2 days of nationwide protest on February 5th and 17th, where demonstrations attracting tens of thousands were organized in all 50 states. Federal workers and union activists, whose jobs were terminated or threatened, also organized large protests in Washington, D.C., and around the country. Opposition to Elon Musk's role in the demolition of the federal government has been expressed in rallies organized in front of Tesla dealerships. In recent days, thousands of constituents flooded Republican and Democratic congressional representatives' town hall meetings to voice their opposition to the Trump-Musk coup and demands to protect democracy. Your reporter spoke with Maria J. Stefan, co-lead and chief organizer with the Horizons Project, and author and editor of 5 books on authoritarianism and civil resistance. Here she talks about her recent article titled, We Are Stronger Than We Think, a discussion on strategies and tactics to effectively challenge government tyranny through the power of collective defiance and nonviolent direct action.
I think we're definitely in the midst of a constitutional crisis now. It's just a question of how to define the severity of it. But I think it's accurate to say that we're experiencing something resembling an administrative coup where the incumbent administration, attempts to systematically undermine checks and balances, to weaponize government agencies, to purge non-loyalists, to punish opponents, to undermine civil liberties, an attempt to basically expand their power. So the power of kind of the Trump administration, Trump insiders, and the Musk kind of billionaire group that is propping up this administration. So we may not be at the point of a full authoritarian consolidation, but the pathway is being laid. You know, there's a crisis in terms of Congress, for example, being completely defanged at this point, not serving at all as a check on power, kind of this dismantling of the administrative state and the weaponization. And that's, you know, when you study dictatorships, both on the left and on the right around the world, that's usually the number one strategy, is to use government agencies to actively, persecute opponents, punish non-loyalists. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
Thank you for that, Maria. So in your article that we'll be discussing tonight, and the title of which is We Are Stronger Than We Think, you write, the long history of popular resistance to government tyranny in this country and globally shows how broad-based movements can prevail. Even in the face of cruelty and abuse, they have relied on a wide range of nonviolent tactics, including those grounded in love, humor, and hope, all while engaging in collective defiance and remaining resilient and disciplined. Inspiring words there. Maria, what have you seen unfold in recent weeks across the country in terms of that resistance developing here, as it has in other countries that you've researched?
I think we're seeing, the spread of various acts of dissent, of loving defiance, of noncompliance, people who are refusing to go along with unlawful orders, to abuses of power, to acts of cruelty. And, it's not just activists and others going out into the streets and demonstrating, although we did see that, the 5051 protests across the country on President's Day. So definitely activist movement groups have been out. But we're also seeing groups like the American Bar Association issuing declarations condemning the administration's attacks on the rule of law. We're seeing the American Association of University Presidents issue statements against anticipatory obedience and, vowing to stand by teachers, students, and communities and not to cave into threats to change curricula, to not teach about certain subjects, to resist efforts to undermine commitments to diversity, equity, and inclusion. You're seeing scientists taking to the streets in protests of cuts to NIH funding and CDC funding. You're seeing youth from different movements. I'm thinking the Get Free group of environmental, racial justice, economic justice activists, and immigrant rights groups who are walking out in a sign of rejection to the mass deportation deportation policies. And so, I mean, that's only a handful of things that are happening. And I think what's interesting is it's broad-based. It's involving lots of different groups across society, some very organic in response to, for example, cuts to federal funding. You may remember when, you know, there was an attempt to freeze funding, which would have affected Head Start and Medicaid, critical services. You had mass mobilization across the country. And these are not only in blue states or districts. These are in red areas and districts. And people saying, no, like, we will, this is unacceptable. These are critical services. So I think you're just starting to see a lots of different groups, including some unlikely folks, starting to engage in acts of noncompliance and just refusing to go along with the status quo. And there's humor in them. They're funny memes. I mean, the civil servants, of course, you know, have been on the front lines following the firing of thousands of civil servants. And so you may remember when the whole fork in the road letter right. that they all received. So in response, you had civil servants who are sharing spoon emojis. And it's like, you know, spoons are better than forks. And it's so, you know, you've got some humor, you've got joy, you've got humanity. That's part of a lot of these acts of defiance happening across the country.
That was Maria J. Stefan, co-lead and chief organizer with the Horizons Project and author of Why Civil Resistance Works: The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. Find a link to her article titled We Are Stronger Than We Think by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During his 2024 presidential election campaign, Donald Trump pledged to end New York City's congestion pricing program. On February 19th, Sean Duffy, Trump's Secretary of Transportation, sent a letter to New York Governor Kathy Hochul, informing her that the administration was revoking federal approval for the program, citing the cost to motorists. In response, the city's Metropolitan Transportation Authority filed a lawsuit to oppose the move. New York's first-in-the-nation congestion pricing program that levies a $9 fee on vehicles entering Lower Manhattan is designed to alleviate traffic gridlock and generate new funds to improve the city's mass transit system. The program also aims to reduce harmful air pollution and carbon emissions that are a major contributor to the global climate crisis. Last June, Governor Hochul delayed implementation of the program shortly before it was to go into effect. But proponents of the program sued and won, and the new toll system went into effect on January 5th this year. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Michael Gerard, director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School, who coordinated the efforts of several groups that advocated for implementation of the congestion pricing program. Here he provides an update on the congestion pricing toll operation thus far and the response to Donald Trump's attempt to kill the program.
So last June, Governor Hochul said that congestion pricing couldn't start, even though the Metropolitan Transportation Authority was already to start. We brought a lawsuit against her saying she didn't have the authority to block it. We won that lawsuit. And shortly after the election, congestion pricing started up. It's gone very well so far. It's led to a reduction in motor vehicle traffic into Manhattan and an increase in subway traffic. However, President Trump, who all along has opposed congestion pricing, now says he wants to stop it. The Federal Highway Administration wrote to the MTA saying, you need to shut it down. The MTA replied by suing. The MTA said that the Federal Highway Administration doesn't have the power to stop it. And so this question is now in federal court. Congestion pricing will continue until and unless a federal judge says it has to stop.
So in Trump world, he doesn't follow the laws. And it seems like there's been several cases already where he's defied judges' rulings. So are you confident that this legal approach will get the result you're hoping for?
I'm reasonably confident, but I can't say 100% confident that if the court says that congestion pricing can continue, that they won't be able to stop it. I don't think they have the legal authority to stop it. And I think that at the end of the day, the government is likely to obey the courts.
Michael Girard, when Governor Hochul stopped congestion pricing, it was just a few weeks before it was supposed to go into effect last June, and it didn't actually start until 6 months later on January 5th of this year. Do you think the fact that it started so close to when Trump took office would make it easier for him to get rid of it, or is that irrelevant?
No, I think what's important is that it started up before the inauguration. I think had it not started up until after the inauguration, it would have been easier for him to prevent it from starting. But once it started up, it makes it harder to stop.
I've read that in the handful of cities where it's been introduced, London is one of them, it was very unpopular at first, but became much more popular as people saw the positive impacts. You said it's already resulted in less congestion and more people taking mass transit. I would imagine that one big benefit is that it would help clean up the air.
Right. It's helpful with air pollution, except that these days most motor vehicles have emission controls like catalytic converters. So the air pollution issue is less now than it was 30 or 40 years ago before that technology was installed. Trucks, especially trucks and buses, heavy-duty vehicles are much dirtier than passenger cars. And if congestion of those goes down as well, that's very helpful. And there are obviously noise and vibration and accidents, all kinds of negative effects from motor vehicle traffic.
Trump talked about how he's saving New Yorkers and also said, "Long live the king," at the same time. Are there ways that lower income people don't have to pay the full $9 a day fee?
The toll scheme provides for a discount for low-income people who live south of 60th Street.
That was Michael Girard, director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School. Learn more about congestion pricing and Donald Trump's attempt to shut it down by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WAAA in Epson, New Hampshire, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KGHI in Westport, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.